Hey, all you spooks and gooks, it's been a minute. This is Adam from Mysterious Chicago. Has been about a year since the last Mysterious Chicago podcast. If you don't know, I've been working on another one called Cemetery Mixtape, which I sometimes describe as being like unboxing videos, but for graves. I take stories from cemeteries all over the place, Chicago and elsewhere, dig deep on the stories behind them, and then have a musical guest come on to write a song for them. It's a really cool podcast. Check it out at cemeterymixtape.com. One subject that I've come across lately was just so cool, I wanted to do it both on Cemetery Mixtape and over here on Mysterious Chicago. There's been a few that I could have done that with. The cemeteries in Chicago are just full of stories that ought to be a lot more famous than they are. Like recently, I found out that there's a guy in the Pinkerton Detective employee lot at Graceland Cemetery named Joseph Witcher, who's on one of the first few episodes of Cemetery Mixtape. He was a detective working for Pinkerton who was murdered by Frank and Jesse James. And the fact that there's a Jesse James victim buried at Graceland that nobody even seems to know about just absolutely blew my mind. But it also doesn't really surprise me because, as I said, they're full of these stories that people knew about when they happened, but nobody really rewrote the story later on, so they just kind of fell through the cracks of history. It's always interesting to find those sort of things. And that's what happened with me lately when I came across the story of this guy, Irving W. Carson. I had just seen this tiny little mention about Rose Hill Cemetery saying that in 1879, President Grant came to visit Rose Hill Cemetery just so he could see the grave of his chief scout, Irving W. Carson. Now, I don't know if Grant really did that or not. I haven't been able to find another reference to Grant attending that cemetery in 1879, certainly not in any 1879 accounts of his visits to Chicago. But I got interested. Who was this Carson guy? And the first thing I looked up said that he was the first journalist to be killed in the war. And in fact, looking further back, I don't think an American journalist had been killed in any war before that, so he was really the first American journalist to be killed in a war, period. So this was quite a story to me, and looking him up more, it got even more interesting. It seemed like his friends talked about him like he was Han Solo or something. Now, this was a young Chicago man. He'd grown up, he apparently grew up in Hartford, though he seems to have told everybody that he was from Scotland. Then he moved to Chicago at about the age of 14. He lived in various places around the Loop, back at the time when that was a much rougher area. One of the places I've got him living, I think, was the area they called Hair Trigger Block at the time, though these neighborhood designations are a little bit fluid. One of them was right where the Harold Washington Library is now, back when that was like really a den of pickpockets and prostitutes and thieves. But he made good for himself. He started out working on the railroad. After that, he became a law clerk for a while. He had just been admitted to the bar himself and become a lawyer when the Civil War broke out. Now, right after the Confederates fired on Fort Sumter, it's something that I don't know that we can really understand anymore. What happened after Fort Sumter just had this huge impact on the nation that I don't think we can understand if we weren't there. You know, like one of the other things that's kept me away from this podcast for a while is I've got this job where I take school groups around different cities, most particularly to New York. And in New York, we usually go to the 9/11 Memorial. And I always give a little talk about it because these kids, these high school kids, a couple of them were born when it happened, but none of them really remember it. Even the very few that were born were like 1 year old by the time that it happened, so they can't really possibly understand what it felt like that day. I mean, all of the adults on the bus will remember exactly where we were that day, exactly what we were doing, just about exactly what it felt like. The same way my grandparents' generation probably remembered Pearl Harbor, and in this case, our great-great or great-great-great-grandparents would have remembered Fort Sumter. It was a very similar thing. If you read papers from after that, this was just huge when the Confederates fired on Fort Sumter. So right after, there was a huge meeting in the old Republican Wigwam building where Lincoln had been nominated just about 6 or 7 months before, about a year before. One of the people attending that meeting was Irving W. Carson, who immediately signed up for a 3-month hitch. So he served under a group called Barker's Dragoons for a while, but after 3 months they came back to Chicago. The group kind of broke up, some of them went off into other regiments, and Carson, it seems, got a job with the Chicago Tribune. And the Tribune sent him down to Cairo, Illinois. I think they've always pronounced it Cairo there. There was a lot. It was down at the southern tip of the state, right on the borders of Missouri and Kentucky, and not too far from Tennessee either. And there was always a lot of secession activity going down there. It was known as a hotbed of treason. So both he and General Grant were sent down there to keep an eye on things and start getting ready to take some of the cities that were nearby. Now, he was officially just there as a reporter from what I can tell, but he was very quickly inserted into Grant's staff, and Grant started using him as a scout. And what he would do is he would sneak behind enemy lines, sometimes just to see where the troops were, sometimes to carry messages around, and sometimes on daring missions of his own. He seems to have acted more or less on his own. There's a terrific article in the New York Herald from very early in his career that said he was sort of his own company, in which he was exclusively the general and the colonel and the lieutenant and the staff and the rank and file all by himself. Early in his career, his friends were telling all of these wild stories about his various exploits. One of my favorites is that after the Battle of Fort Donelson, they'd captured a lot of Confederate soldiers. One of them had a letter on him from his sister saying, "Could you please send me a Yankee boy to keep as a pet?" So he held on to that letter, found out where the address was, and went to the young woman's house and said, "All right, your brother captured me. I'm here to be your pet. Now feed me." It was just a prank. He'd ended up running away before the neighbors could kill him. Other times he would sneak in pretending to be a farmer and end up being able to get entire maps of the enemy's fortifications. Now, eventually he got a little too cocky. He was even quoted by one of his friends. Shortly after this happened, he was quoted as saying that he had been in so many near-miss scrapes that he was almost invincible. He said, "The ball has not yet been cast and will never be cast that could hit me." Which, well, we've all seen movies in this day and age, so you kind of know what's going to happen after that. It would be logical to think it was some kind of Poe Dameron-like exploit that eventually got him killed, but it really wasn't. During the Battle of Shiloh, Grant sent him off to find out where General Buell's forces were, as he was trying to figure out, can I hold this down? If I get reinforcements, we'll be okay. Otherwise, we better retreat. So Carson was sent back to find out where Buell was, came back to say, no, don't retreat, and reinforcements are on the way. Now, right after he delivered that news, a cannonball got him right in the head. And that was it. It was the end of Irving W. Carson, a guy that other reporters said could have gone on to be the editor of a major newspaper, could have gone on to be a general himself. He'd attracted some fame in his day, and a lot of people said that his adventures would have filled a book, but unfortunately, not enough of those were written down that we actually can write a book. We've got a couple of letters the guy wrote that were reprinted later, but not enough that we can really get inside of his head or know what was thinking with the guy. Just a lot of stories about a guy that they described as being fairly mysterious. I don't think most of the other soldiers even knew that he was a reporter on the side. So this makes things difficult, because what I'd love to do, the real mystery left to solve, is to figure out which dispatches to the Chicago Tribune were his. I mean, this is history. This is the first journalist killed in the war. We should know what he wrote. A couple of writers who've written about that era have just assumed that everything postmarked Cairo that was in the Tribune was him, but it's not really foolproof. There is one, though, one that I found in particular, that it probably holds like the key to helping to solve the rest of them. See, there were two other regular Tribune reporters who were working in the area, a guy named Bodman, whose dispatches were usually signed with a B, and there was George Upton, who usually signed GPU. Now, most of the dispatches don't have a name at all. There's one of them signed with a C that we can assume is Carson. But shortly after the Battle of Fort Donelson in late February of 1862, there was a day when they published a dispatch marked B, a dispatch marked GPU, and then a long unsigned one that I think almost certainly would have been Carson, just by process of elimination, if anything else. And also, it seems a little bit more like the work of an amateur writer, and also he was stationed right aboard the gunboat Conestoga at the time, which I don't think the other reporters would have been. And I'll just read some excerpts from this, just to try to bring him back to life. I was delighted to find that from the ones that we can find, the guy really was an excellent writer. And in this one, we find him in a particularly jovial mood and trying to work in as many puns as he possibly can in combat journalism. So here's Irving W. Carson, February 25th, 1862. Well, it was dated February 20th. "I am now lying at Clarksville. Honest confession for a newspaper correspondent. I will change it. The Conestoga is now lying here, and I am writing on her gun deck by the lantern burning dimly. First a bit from Pillow, Gideon J. Pillow, late Confederate Generalissimo at Donelson, who took precious good pains not to be too late to get away. He is a little particular about the location of his ditches, an old trick of his, and he was always careful to interpose the ditch called the Cumberland between himself and General Grant. Gideon, on assuming command at Fort Donelson, gave under his hand and seal the following, which I copy from the original document. The handwriting is bad. The lantern a little nearer, dear Sergeant. And here he transcribes Pillow's General Order Number 1, which made himself the commander of the fort and proclaimed the battle cry to be liberty or death, which is an interesting thing considering that Pillow did in fact own lots and lots of slaves. Now this is well done of Gideon, who from this seems to be a very good Pillow for a military head. But the proof came later, and the valiant general, in choosing between liberty or death, took excellent care that it should be the former and of the largest pattern. I think he will publish his order as historical and not before in print. But with all this, imagine us going up the Cumberland. We left Fort Donelson on the morning of Wednesday the 19th, following some hours after the U.S. gunboat Cairo. Our trip was marked with little to interest. The Conestoga is of the racer breed of boats and walked on the water like a thing of life, an entirely original term, I beg you to note. When General Foote has dispatch in his eyes, he takes the Conestoga. I have observed it is customary to praise the boat you ride on, but this is not merited, not a puff, the Conestoga not being now in the carrying trade. Though, by the way, I take that back, she did the other day help to carry Fort Henry. Just above Donelson, we passed the still-smoking ruins of the Cumberland Ironworks, which do not now cumber the land with appliances to aid the rebels. The blackness of ashes marks where they stood, as the wizard remarked to Mr. Lochiel. Will the printer stand by and hold hard with quotation marks? At 3 p.m., the Conestoga rounded a bend in the river called Linwood Landing, and before us loomed Fort Sevier. It was severely situated for us had it been of hostile capacity and intent, for the muzzles of its few cannon looked down almost down on our chimneys from a height 200 feet above our heads. We counted 2 guns and a white flag, and that settled it. There was nothing to fear from Fort Sevier. Clarksville is now in the Union, and her scared residents may come home again. They are fond of the white flag. It will be better that they float the red, white, and blue. Our land forces are in possession, and the way is open to Nashville. We shall hear from there soon that the stars and stripes are floating there, and there are many in Nashville who will welcome the day. God speed it. So that is Captain Carson about 6 weeks before he was killed. So if you check out the Mysterious Chicago blog over on mysterioushicago.com, they have a large post with a lot more excerpts of things that I think are probably by him. And one thing we can do is, assuming that that one is actually his work, we can kind of go through a lot of the other dispatches that were written and just find which ones are that pun happy. And quite a few of them, even the ones that are just mundane listings of things that are going on in camp life, really do seem to go out of their way to work in a pun. That's probably the work of Captain Carson for you. His funeral was held here in Chicago. He ended up being buried at Rose Hill Cemetery. He's a part of my regular Rose Hill Cemetery tours. I'll be doing quite a lot of them this fall, so just by way of shameless plug, it's about to start up ghost tour season again. All through September and October, I'll be doing ghost tours on Friday and Saturday nights downtown. Not to mention, I'll actually be doing the ghost tours at the Lincoln Park Zoo this year. Also, we're going to be having H.H. Holmes tours all month. There will be Grave Robbing 101 tours, a couple of iterations of the Architecture of Mysterious Chicago tour that I started up a while ago, and lots of cemetery tours as well. It is going to be a busy fall. It's been a busy summer. I can't wait to have a busy fall as well. Tours for myself and also through Atlas Obscura, so check everything out at mysterioushicago.com. And if you want to hear more things like this, be sure to move over to the new podcast, Cemetery Mixtape, at cemeterymixtape.com. I am Adam. Thank you very much.